Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. This is another in this occasional series of readings from and brief notes and commentary upon Eusebius of Caesarea's The Ecclesiastical History. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Book 8, Chapters 16 and 17, and also an appendix to Book 8. So, let's begin. Chapter 16. Such was the state of affairs that continued throughout the whole persecution, which came completely to an end by the grace of God in the 10th year, though indeed it began to abate after the 8th year. For when the divine and heavenly grace showed that it watched over us with kindly and propitious regard, then indeed our rulers also, those very persons who had long time committed acts of war against us, changed their minds in the most marvelous manner and gave utterance to a recantation, quenching the fire of persecution that had blazed so furiously by means of merciful edicts and the most humane ordinances. But this was not due to any human agency, nor to the pity, as one might say, or humanity of the rulers. Far from it. For from the beginning up to that time, they were daily plotting further and severer measures against us. From time to time, they were inventing fresh assaults upon us by means of still more varied devices. But it was due to the manifestation of the divine providence itself, which, while it became reconciled to the people, attacked the perpetrator of these evils, and was wroth with him as the chief author of the wickedness of the persecution as a whole. For verily, though it was destined that these things should come to pass as a divine judgment, yet the Scripture says, "Woe, through whomsoever the offense cometh." A divinely sent punishment, I say, executed vengeance upon him, beginning at his very flesh and proceeding to the soul. For all at once an abscess appeared in the midst of his privy parts, then a deeply seated fistular ulcer, which could not be cured, and ate their way into the very midst of his entrails. Hence there sprang an innumerable multitude of worms, and a deadly stench was given off, since the entire bulk of his members had, through gluttony, even before the disease, been changed into an excessive quantity of soft fat, which then became putrid and presented an intolerable and most fearful sight to those that came near. As for the physicians, some of them were wholly unable to endure the exceeding and unearthly stench and were butchered. Others, who could not be of any assistance since the whole mass was swollen and reached a point where there was no hope of recovery, were put to death without mercy. Chapter 17. And wrestling with such terrible misfortunes, he was conscience-stricken for the cruel deeds he had perpetrated against the godly. Collecting therefore his thoughts, he first openly confessed to the God of the universe. Then he called those around him and commanded them without delay to cause the persecution against Christians to cease, and by an imperial law and decree to urge them to build their churches and to perform their accustomed rites, offering prayers on the emperor's behalf. Action immediately followed his word, and imperial ordinances were promulgated in each city, containing the recantation of the persecution edicts of our time, after this manner. The emperor Caesar Galerius Valerius Maximianus Invictus Augustus Pontifex Maximus Germanicus Maximus Egypticus Maximus Thebaicus Maximus Sarmaticus Maximus five times, Persicus Maximus twice, Carpicus Maximus six times, Armenicus Maximus, Medicus Maximus, Abiadbenicus Maximus, holding the tribunician power for the 20th time, emperor for the 19th time, consul for the 8th, father of his country, proconsul, and the emperor Caesar Flavius Valerius Constantius Pius Felix Invictus Augustus Pontifex Maximus, holding the tribunician power, emperor for the 5th time, consul, father of his country, proconsul, and the emperor Caesar Valerius Licinianus Licinius, Pius, Felix, Invictus, Augustus, Pontifex Maximus, holding the tribunician power for the fourth time, emperor for the third time, consul, father of his country, proconsul, to the people of their provinces, greeting. Among the other measures that we framed for the use and profit of the state, it had been our own wish formerly that all things should be set to rights in accordance with the ancient laws and public order of the Romans, and to make provision for this, namely that the Christians also, such as had abandoned the persuasion of their own ancestors, should return to a sound mind, seeing that through some reasoning they had been possessed of such self-will and seized with such folly, that instead of following the institutions of the ancients, which perchance their own forefathers had formerly established, they made for themselves and were observing laws merely in accordance with their own disposition, and as each one wished, and were assembling various multitudes in diverse places. Therefore, when a command of ours soon followed to the intent that they should betake themselves to the institutions of the ancients, very many indeed were subject to peril, while very many were harassed and endured all kinds of death. And since the majority held to the same folly, and we perceived that they were neither paying the worship due to the gods of heaven, nor honoring the God of the Christians, having regard to our clemency and the invariable custom by which we were wont to accord pardon to all men, we thought it right in this case also to extend most willingly our indulgence, that Christians may exist again and build the houses in which they used to assemble, always provided that they do nothing contrary to order. In another letter, we shall indicate to the judges how they should proceed. Wherefore, in accordance with this our indulgence, they will be bound to beseech their own God for our welfare and that for the state and their own. And in every way, both the well-being of the state may be secured and they may be enabled to live free from care in their own homes. Such is the character of the edict in the Latin tongue, translated into Greek, as well as may be. Now it is time to consider carefully what happened subsequently. And here now is the appendix to Book 8. But the author of the edict, after such a confession, was immediately, though not for long, released from his pains and so departed this life. It is recorded that this same person was the prime author of the calamity of the persecution. Since long before the movement of the other emperors, he had used force to turn aside from the faith the Christians in the army, and, first of all, those in his own house, degrading some from their military rank and heaping the most shameful insults on them. And since he was already threatening others even with death and finally had stirred up his partners in the principate to the general persecution, it is not possible to pass over the ends of these same emperors in silence. Four then had divided the supreme power between them. Those who were the more advanced in age and honor retired from the principate not 2 whole years after the persecution began, as we have already stated, and passed the remainder of their existence like ordinary private citizens. The end of their lives fell out thus. The one who had attained the chief place in honor and age fell a victim to a prolonged and most painful infirmity of the body, while he who held the second place to him ended his life by strangling, suffering this fate in accordance with a certain demoniacal prediction, for the numerous crimes he had perpetrated. Of those after them, he who held the last place, the same who was the originator, as we stated, of the whole persecution, suffered the fate which we have mentioned above. But he who ranked next before him, that kindest and mildest of emperors, Constantius, passed the whole period of his principate in a manner worthy of his high office, and in other respects displayed himself in a most beneficent and favorable light to all. Yea, and he held himself aloof from the war against us, and carefully preserved his God-fearing subjects from injury and harsh treatment. Neither did he pull down the church buildings, nor employ any other additional new devices against us at all. So he has had his reward, a truly happy and thrice blessed issue of his life. For he alone met with a favorable and glorious end while he was still emperor, with a lawful son, in all respects most prudent and godly, to succeed him in the office. He, from the very first, was proclaimed by the armies most perfect emperor and Augustus, and he set himself to be an emulator of his father's piety towards our doctrine. Such was the issue which befell at different times the lives of the four men of whom we have written above. Of these same persons, he of whom we spoke a little while ago alone still remained. And in conjunction with those who subsequently were admitted to the principate, only placed before all the aforesaid confession in the document which was set out above. Here ends the appendix, and with that, this brings to an end the book 8. And so we'll move on now to some notes and some commentary. Chapter 16 describes how the great Diocletian persecution began to lessen by the 8th year and came to an end in the 10th year. This change did not come about, according to Eusebius, due to human agency or pity or from the humanity of the rulers. Instead, it came about by divine providence. One sign of this, according to Eusebius, was that Galerius, the cruel emperor and chief author of the persecution, was stricken by an illness which began with an ulcer and wasted his entrails, bringing forth worms and a terrible stench. The suffering described here is reminiscent of Herod's illness in Acts 12, verse 23. Chapter 17 describes how Galerius became conscience-stricken for his cruel deeds and decided to command the persecution against Christians to cease. This chapter includes a copy of this decree translated from Latin to Greek, allowing in the end that the Christians may exist again and build the houses in which they assemble, always provided they do nothing contrary to order. In an appendix to Book 8 that is found in the AER manuscript tradition, more information is added as to the fate of the four men who served as the Tetrarchy and under whom the persecution had begun. It is noted that Galerius, who held last place among the four Tetrarchs, died from his illness, and that he had been the chief villain in the persecutions. Diocletian had held the chief honor in the Tetrarchy, thus we refer to it today as the Diocletian persecution, but he had retired early from public life and eventually fell under painful bodily infirmity. The one who held second place was Maximian, whose life ended by strangling. The Tetrarch in third place had been Constantius, the father of Constantine, and he is praised as the only one who lived a noble life and who did not persecute Christians or tear down their churches. And because of this, he died in comfort and not in pain as the other Tetrarchs did. One begins to see in this a bit of Constantinian propaganda, as Constantius is seen as the best of the four Tetrarchs, and he's defended as not having taken part in the persecutions. In conclusion, these chapters describe the welcomed end of the Diocletian persecution, and they stress the divine providential care that was extended toward the church in ending this great period of persecution and suffering. Well, this brings this episode to a conclusion. Hope this has been helpful and edifying to those who are listening. And I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Till then, take care and God bless.